Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I will talk with assistant editor Alexi Sargent about Silence, the 1966 novel by Shusaku Endo, newly adapted as a film by Martin Scorsese. We'll ask all the important questions. Is the film better than the book? Will it win all the Oscars? Will it convert you to Death of God theology? Then, Leah Labresco joins us for a discussion of Sherlock, the BBC's very popular update of Arthur Conan Doyle's Great Detective, now in its fourth and possibly final season. Is the series better or worse now than when it began? Is an iPhone cooler than a pocket watch? Is Sherlock an addict or isn't he? What's up with the Sherlock fandom? What's up with the show's female characters? And what do we want to see in the season finale? Warning, this episode is full of spoilers. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. In 1966, Shusaku Endo published Silence, a novel about Jesuit missionaries to Japan in the 17th century, a time of great persecution of Christians in that country. The English translation of Silence was published in 1969, and it impressed Graham Greene and various other novelists. It also impressed a young Martin Scorsese, who would spend nearly 30 years incubating a film adaptation, which is now in wide theatrical release. In the role of our hero, the idealistic young Jesuit Rodriguez, Silence stars Andrew Garfield, whom you may recognize from one of his previous incarnations as the Spider-Man who is not Tobey Maguire. In the role of his companion, the gritty young Jesuit Garupe, Silence stars Adam Driver. You may have seen him, every inch of him, on HBO's Girls. As their former teacher, the notorious Jesuit Ferreira, Silence stars Liam Neeson, known to casting directors as the second most obvious choice to play a notorious Jesuit after Jeremy Irons. Anyway, this film was supposed to be Oscar bait and it has received praise, but a lot of critics are not at all into it, calling it torture porn and tedious and a passion project that gestated for too long. The American public has remained mostly aloof, and the film has struck out so far in the early part of awards season. I'm here with assistant editor Alexi Sargent to take a hard look at Silence, both the novel and the film. So let's start with the novel. Alexi, why don't you summarize the basic plot?
Sure thing, Julia. Silence follows two young, idealistic, somewhat naive Jesuit missionaries who sneak into Japan during the Edo period persecutions of Japanese Christians. No foreigners are supposed to be coming into the country. They're coming in to find their erstwhile wayward mentor, Ferreira, who has supposedly apostatized, though these two Jesuits don't believe that that could be true. When they come, they find an underground Christian community that hosts them. They administer the sacraments to these beleaguered believers. Then the persecution gets wind of them as inquisitors show up in the village, capturing Christians and trying to find these priests. The two separate, and our protagonist, Rodriguez, travels by himself until he's betrayed by his guide and thinks he's heading to a glorious martyrdom. But it turns out his captors and the author have other things in plan for him that are less glorious. So in the climactic scene of the novel, Rodriguez is presented with the opportunity to apostatize specifically by trampling on an image of Christ called a fumie. And he is tortured about this, but decides to do it anyway.
He's talked into it by Ferreira.
Yes, he meets Ferreira, who has indeed apostatized, and Ferreira tells him that this is the most painful act of love one can do, that in order to protect his Christian flock, to stop the authorities from capturing and torturing the Christians of Japan, he, their shepherd, should deny Christ and apostatize. In fact, Ferreira says, faced with this, Christ would have apostatized. The true martyrdom is denying the faith.
So one of the major conflicts in this novel is Rodriguez's spiritual crisis. He gets to Japan, he's expecting to be a missionary and do great things. Instead, he accidentally causes all these hidden Christians to get found out, and they are tortured and martyred because of his presence in Japan. The events happening around him seem to controvert the idea that God is benevolent and is at work in the world. And so the motif is the silence of God. He feels that God is silent, God is not speaking to him. Why does God not speak to him when he prays to God? So in 17th century Japan, this young Jesuit is caught in a spiritual crisis that many may have thought was a very 20th century kind of thing. You know, this clearly struck a chord in the 1960s and 1970s, and the novel came to be regarded as a sort of spiritual masterpiece. What do you think, Alexei? Spiritual masterpiece?
Well, it's harrowing to read. I don't know that it's a spiritual masterpiece so much as a existential masterpiece. It doesn't give me the sense of a person deeply formed in prayer, but rather someone who has this very modern idea of struggling with God and a very modern idea of cultural incompatibility. Because one, the motif is the silence of God, but part of that motif is the idea that God is drowned out by the swamp of Japan, the buzzing of the flies, the crashing of the waves, these kind of features of Japan keep God out. And so the inquisitors tell Rodriguez, you know, perhaps Catholicism is true in your country of Portugal, but here in Japan it's been judged to be useless. And the novel leaves open the question that maybe they're right. Maybe they're right that Christianity as we know it is not useful in Japan and it has to deny itself and be transformed.
I found the novel to be not exactly a masterpiece. I mean, partly because of what you said, I have these sort of issues with its theology or lack thereof, but I also have problems with it on the level of craft, and I should preface this criticism with an acknowledgement that, listen, this thing was written in ideograms, and I don't know too much about the translation of East Asian literature into Western languages and how these artifacts tend to work when they're reconfigured for Westerners, but I found the characterizations, including fatally that of Rodriguez, to be quite vague. I felt that Rodriguez's mental life is not textured in a way that renders him and his spiritual concerns concrete and unique. He has these pious sentiments that carry him across the sea, but the mundane practice of his piety is mostly invisible to us. I remember being surprised by the moment in the novel when he takes apart his rosary and distributes the beads to the peasants who are just desperate to have icons because they don't have any of them. And I thought, gosh, Rodriguez, do you carry a rosary? Do you ever use it? We don't see him at prayer in a sort of ordinary daily way, certainly not in a thick way. You know, when he says a Hail Mary, how does that prayer sort of overlay his daily experience on a particular day, not a typical or average day, but a particular day? You know, how do the words of that prayer and the images they call up intertwine with his thoughts and his feelings and even his physical sensations on a particular day? You know, and if you give me that, then you're beginning to give me a character who is real, who's unique, whose experiences are really unrepeatable. And that seems to me what novels that are really succeeding characteristically do. And I don't think that Endo does that. And so for me, the crisis remains a bit notional. It remains a bit formulaic. You know, young man has bad experience, so questions God. I don't think it doesn't attain the sort of universal through the particular that is the mark of successful fictive art.
Some of that stems from the form the novel takes, because Endo wrote it and the translation preserves it as a partially epistolary novel, where a lot of it is written in first person by Rodriguez writing back to his superiors, and then that cuts out at about when he's captured. So he stops telling his own story at that point. It becomes a third person perspective on him. And then after his apostasy itself, it pulls even further back. So not just an omniscient third person narrator that can, you know, still read Rodriguez's mind, it becomes another first-person narrator, a Dutch trader who is viewing the Japanese also from this critical Western distance and hears of these apostate priests and is interested in them.
Right. I mean, a third-person narrator can be very closely attached to the consciousness of a character. A third-person narrator can do anything. There's no reason that choice would be limiting in this respect. And even when we have Rodriguez speaking for himself, I do find it very formulaic. So I'll just read one example. This is from right around a third of the way into the novel. Two peasants have just been martyred. And so this is kind of the first really big bad thing that happens to him. And he writes, like the sea, God was silent. His silence continued. No, no, I shook my head. I love that generic stage direction. If God does not exist, how can man endure the monotony of the sea and its cruel lack of emotion? From the deepest core of my being, yet another voice made itself heard in a whisper, supposing God does not exist, dot, dot, dot. This was a frightening fancy. If he does not exist, how absurd the whole thing becomes. The missionaries who spent 3 years crossing the sea to arrive at this country, what an illusion was theirs. Yeah, that's tough. But I would say any Christian believer in that spot would be able to say pretty much the same thing in pretty much those words. You know, if God doesn't exist, what are we doing here? It's not a very particularized crisis. And so I find it actually not very moving and not very successful as literature.
You may be expecting a different thing from the novel. The novel might be trying to make a more general statement, make a statement about a type rather than about such a specific
character. That is not what novels are supposed to do. Well, I would say in the Western tradition, that's not what novels are supposed to do. That's usually considered a failed novel. But I don't know. I don't know much about Japanese literature. So with that caveat, those are my reservations about the novel. So, but let's talk about the film. I personally preferred the film to the novel just because it immediately, you know, and necessarily addresses my issues with concreteness and particularity by actually showing us a physical world and actually giving us actors who automatically sort of bring a presence. You know, whether they're brilliantly cast or not, they're at least there on the screen, and I sort of get who Andrew Garfield is. He has a thing. I know a lot of people have objected to his casting, but I at least can see him and recognize him as a distinct human being. And so just on that level, I preferred the film. I thought the images of martyrdom were extremely moving.
Yeah, I was angrier at the end of the film than I was at the end of the novel. I think part of it is I feel more sympathy with Endo as a conflicted Catholic than with Scorsese as someone with a Catholic background who's not, you know, mass going, right? Who is interested in Catholic issues but presenting them more from this Hollywood liberal point of view. And so the particular glimmer of hope Scorsese decides to leave at the end of the film, something he's added onto the novel, is a final shot where the camera zooms in to the Buddhist casket in which Rodriguez is being cremated at the end of his life as an apostate priest. And this camera zooms in to show us a little hand-carved crucifix he has palmed in his hand. And the way it's framed, it's supposed to seem like some kind of a moment of qualified triumph, some kind of a bittersweet hope left at the end of the movie. But for me, it was just infuriating because that's the perfect image of this totally liberalized faith, right? A faith that is hidden away in your palm while everything about you that's visible to the external world has been completely conformed to the dominant culture and a faith that's not your own, right? Rodriguez, by the end of the story, both in the novel and the film, has been repeatedly denying Christ because the authorities demand him re-up his apostasy every so often just to make sure he doesn't backslide into Catholicism. So if he's still smuggling this crucifix, that means he has some relationship with God. And Scorsese seems to be saying that's the important thing. But if it's a priest who's, you know, denied Christ, taken a Japanese wife, and become this total servile minister of the state that's persecuting his co-religionists, how can we really call that a glimmer of hope? Right, that is a vision of a supine church, and you know, very convenient for a Hollywood liberal to be able to hold that up as an example of faith.
Very convenient and very consistent with something that was really hot in the 60s and 70s when this novel gained its stature, and that's Death of God theology.
Yeah.
The notion that the truest Christianity or the truest Christian humility involves evacuating Christianity of its dogmatic content and becoming indistinguishable from cultures that are not Christian. And this seems to be essentially what Christ is telling Rodriguez in the scene of trampling on the fumier. He says, trample, trample. It was to be trampled on by men that I was born into this world. Okay, so that's nice. See, I had thought that initially it was just trampling on the image of Christ was a necessary evil so that the peasants who are being threatened don't get martyred. because of the priest's stubbornness. But no, it turns out, take the peasants out of the picture, Christ wants you to deny him because that's the greatest Christian humility or something.
It's the third degree of humility.
Right, as Father James Martin said on Twitter, or where did he say that?
I looked up Ignatian spiritual exercises. That's not the third degree of humility. This is a misinterpretation. But I do want to be very fair to Scorsese. I tried to look up, you know, his own words on this topic, so I'm not kind of putting into his mouth this lionization and betrayal, right? I want to know what he actually thinks. And so fortunately, he's written for us this foreword to this edition of Silence, published by Picador Modern Classics. And in the foreword, he says that Endo understood that in order for Christianity to live, to adapt itself to other cultures and historical moments, it needs not just the figure of Christ, but the figure of Judas as well. This does suggest that, as in his movie The Last Temptation of Christ, Scorsese still holds up Judas not as a betrayer, but as a kind of saint. That Judas's turning over Christ to the authorities, that's what we should really emulate.
So we have theological problems with this film. For me, the turn to this kind of theology in the trampling scene creates also narrative problems. It makes the story incoherent. And this is true of both the novel and the film. Because after reading about, or especially viewing, these scenes of martyrdom where these poor peasants are being burned or drowned because they won't apostatize or because a priest didn't apostatize, I'm strongly invested in those martyrs. I viscerally believe that their sacrifices were meaningful, that their sacrifices were not like stupidly misguided or inferior to those of the apostate Jesuits who have this proto-Bonhoeffer thing going. I think the notion that Jesus died so that Jesuits could go native is completely daffy. I think it's offensive after I have watched what I have watched. And if we are to buy the theology there, we actually need to be convinced by Ferreira's arguments about how Christianity is bogus, or this is actually what Jesus wants, or whatever he's saying. We also need to be convinced by the nobility of his comfortable life as an apostate in Japan. But Ferreira's arguments seem very cowardly and self-serving, and his lifestyle is, of course, repulsive. And when Rodriguez joins him in that lifestyle, it's repulsive. So in order to buy the theology that's being sold in this novel, in this film, I think we have to betray our very vital sense that the martyred peasants are in fact superior to the apostate Jesuits, and I can't do that.
I think you can read this text, right, novel and film, as a story about how the more simple, more straightforward, more trusting, and more tragic faith of these peasants who are killed for a belief in God they love through the sacraments but don't know through theology textbooks is superior to the complicated, tortured, and ultimately treacherous faith of the highly educated Jesuits.
But not if you take seriously the theological propositions of the trampling scene. And so I guess that's the question. Are we to take that seriously or not? You know, are we to think well of Rodriguez because he, you know, smuggled that little crucifix into his hand in his funeral pyre and say, oh yes, he was actually a good priest. He was actually the best priest. Jesus wanted him to trample on that fumier. You know, it's just it's hard to hold together. And I don't actually find it to be a compelling paradox. I think it's just an incoherence at the heart of this project.
Yeah, you know whose story I'd rather hear? I'd rather hear the story of his Japanese wife, right? The widow who he's attached to after his apostasy in order to like fully integrate him into Japanese society, who in Scorsese's telling is the one who sneaks the crucifix into his hand when he's being brought away for cremation. So did she convert? Did her apostate priest husband make her Christian, or is she doing this as a favor to this strange man who is put into her life? I think her story might be more interesting, but then I think the story of many of these Japanese characters might be more interesting than the story of these Jesuits who come to try to minister to them and end up denying Christ.
You're probably aware of Sherlock, the BBC's very trendy update of Sherlock Holmes, which places the great detective in 21st century London for three feverishly anticipated episodes every 3 years or so, give or take a trippy Christmas special. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman as John Locke. That's a shipping joke. If you have to ask, you don't want to know. Fangirls love it with a detailed intensity that strikes me as unusual. Critics love it too, or did until recently. Sherlock is back this month with its fourth and possibly final season. As of this recording, the first two episodes have aired, and we're awaiting Sunday night's season finale, which may be the series finale. At the risk of making this podcast episode rather too busy adjusting lofty reputations downward, Alexi Sargent and I are going to express our opinions of Sherlock. We're joined in this endeavor by Leah Labresco, also known as Leah Labresco Sargent, who recently married some guy I know. Leah, good to have you.
Good to be here.
All right, so what do you guys think? What does the BBC's Sherlock have going for it over its four seasons? What does it not do so well? Is it getting better, getting worse?
I think I enjoyed the earlier episodes of this show more, at the risk of fatally destroying my reputation for being the positive voice on the First Things podcast. I really have to say, I think Sherlock in recent seasons has become less entertaining because it's gotten more and more entangled in complicated plots about Sherlock himself rather than stories where Sherlock solves crimes. Sherlock instead is involved in conflicts between his various siblings and their mysterious agendas.
And I think that's a particular shame because one of the things that was most delightful about Sherlock in its early seasons is it's one of the most successful TV shows set in the present day that I'm aware of. It was literally the first show I saw or saw discussed that used cell phones successfully, especially in the mystery.
Text messaging in particular. So for listeners who don't know, Sherlock was maybe the first major series to render text messages superimposed over an ordinary shot. So instead of wasting a shot looking at the physical phone and having people read the message off of the phone, it just kind of superimposes it over a wall or a window or whatever. And that works kind of beautifully, a kind of weirdly spectral and interesting representation of the way in which text messages sort of infiltrate our lives.
That cinematography is also used for Sherlock making deductions about things, where
right.
he'll look at someone and then see text popping up explaining what the marks and
right.
telltale signs on them mean.
He sort of annotates people's faces and physiognomies in these strange ways.
And I think that gave the sense of kind of an intensely layered world. The technological
mm-hmm.
layer we're all enmeshed in, other layers that are discernible to Sherlock and not to us, and each person is being at the center of many small stories present in their bodies, right?
Right.
And as the series has gone on, all of those stories have become less interesting to the writers, to the characters, and as Alexi said, more and more of the stories are just about Sherlock himself, and there's less of a sense that his England is populated by lots of people with their own specific small agendas that he's enmeshed in only insofar as there's a crime, and more that there are maybe like eight people in England, all of whom spend most of their time thinking about Sherlock Holmes.
And how to get revenge on him slash become romantically entangled with him or both.
That's this series in a nutshell at this point, I'm afraid. I'm gonna, just before we move on, I'd just like to inject my appreciation for something else that it does. I mean, so Leah, you've mentioned that Sherlock is really good at existing in the present day. Well, it's also really good at updating an old Victorian property for the present day. I think one of the pleasures of the series in the early going was just seeing what all is entailed and sort of taking this guy who's a very peculiar personality with interesting cognitive abilities and transplanting him from late Victorian London to contemporary London. And so a great example of that was in the first episode, A Study in Pink, there's the scene in which Sherlock examines John's iPhone, which was something he had sort of inherited from his sister, had given to him, had once been hers, now is his. And this is obviously a callback to a very famous scene in The Sign of Four, which is the second Sherlock Holmes novel, in which Holmes examines Watson's pocket watch, which he had inherited from his brother. And Holmes figures out by looking at it that Watson's brother was a drunkard. And so Sherlock does in the BBC series a similar thing with John's iPhone. And it's just sort of interesting to see, you know, the details that have to be shifted in order to update, make that update from a pocket watch to an iPhone. And then just more broadly, other characteristics, how do they change in order to stay the same when you move this guy out of the late 19th century into the early 21st? So instead of smoking a pipe, he has nicotine patches. I mean, I find that one actually really gimmicky and didn't really appreciate it, but this was, you know, it's very intricate the way they've done this, and they pursued it in a pretty serious way. And I think that for me was one of the great charms, at least in the early going of the series.
I think, Julia, you're right that in any medium and version, one of the joys of the Sherlock Holmes character is getting to see him make deductions, particularly these seemingly supernatural deductions where he is able to glean a great deal about someone from very little. And then the formula goes, John Watson says, how did you learn that? And Sherlock is like, well, it's quite obvious, and then spells out how he picked up all this information from a few choice details. And the problem that bothered me in the first episode of this most recent season of Sherlock is that they kept these supernatural deductions, but never had Sherlock explain himself, or even like other characters ask him to explain himself, because at this point they're all just used to him making these. So instead of Sherlock seeming like a great detective who picks up on small details, Sherlock seems like someone who's looked ahead in the script for this episode of Sherlock.
Right. The other great strength, I think, of the series is its casting, right? I mean, we're always told that Benedict Cumberbatch is the only person who read for Sherlock because he's tall and he has this weird face and he looks like he's cold all the time. And so he just seems like this sort of cerebral, disembodied, strange intellect. And then Martin Freeman as John Watson is basically a hobbit. He's very earnest and British and exasperated all the time. And they have a chemistry or something. Alexi, you're an actor. What's your thought about these two gents?
I think you're right that Cumberbatch is playing perfectly to type as Sherlock. He's someone who's well known for his portrayal of Hamlet recently as well, another tortured cerebral loner. And unfortunately for Hamlet, he doesn't have quite as good a Watson. You know, Horatio tries, but he's not as, you know, both warm and a little bit irascible as Watson in Martin Freeman's portrayal, which is what makes for such a good dynamic between the two of them.
I think it's also easy to give more credit to Cumberbatch because he's doing a showier part, right? With the motor mouth and the mannerisms. But I love Freeman in the part because for the same reason I loved him in The Hobbit and hated the actual Hobbit adaptation. Every time he's in the background of the scene, he's doing something great. And he's not pulling focus, but he's just vividly alive and responsive to everything that happens. And I think, you know, it's often Friedman's responsiveness that gives their friendship, you know, the undeniable power it has on screen.
Yes, Watson has a great lived-in quality. You really buy him as a real person.
I think the sort of tough love dynamic of their relationship can be overdone. I mean, they kind of have the same spats over and over again. And don't even get me started on the gay jokes that were just an obsessively recurrent feature of the first three seasons. A lot of people had a lot of objections to that for a lot of reasons. Just bugged me on the level of storytelling. But there's something very overdone about the dynamics of their relationship.
I think there's often a fondness in the way they repeat fights, especially again in the early seasons, which is part of what gives, you know, the jokes about their other forms of relationships, because they sound like an old married couple where even the things that frustrate them about each other are kind of a little adorable after all this time to each of them. And I find that to be realistic and charming. What's been more frustrating is in the recent season where there's an effort to really test their friendship, or what the writers think, like testing the friendship isn't, you know, external troubles or, you know, going through grief. It's, you know, dramatic betrayals, murder, and all these kind of unrealistic things that don't really even stem from anything in them or in the friendship so much, just stem from a desire for sensationalism.
Let's talk in a bit more detail about the current season, and especially let's begin with the major event that happened at the end of the first episode, which is that John's wife, Mary, died. She took a bullet that was meant for Sherlock, and she sadly expired. Mary is, of course, an updated version of Watson's wife in the original stories. She's rather different from the original Mary Morstan. She's a retired assassin, which is cool, I guess. She dies violently, and she says in a posthumous video message, basically, "Hey guys, it's okay. I expected to die violently because my past was very violent and checkered, and it had consequences. So you're supposed to feel okay about that," or something. And John should not blame Sherlock for the fact that Mary's dead. Thoughts about the death of Mary?
Ugh. So I think, you know, there were problems to begin with in the idea that to make Mary interesting or a match for Watson, she needs to be a retired assassin. I think that points to kind of the problems we're really seeing break into full bloom in this season, where the creators of the show have lost confidence that ordinary people or ordinary right. lives or ordinary crimes are interesting.
In order to be interesting, you have to either be a sociopath or be the kind of person who's compulsively attracted to sociopaths. So you either have to be Sherlock and Mary or you have to be John.
And I think it's a shame. I think it really limits their storytelling. You can see how much narrower their world has gotten now that we have Les Gregg, the inspector, who's fascinating and delightful and also has a nice dynamic, but there's no space for him in a world of nothing but super criminals and sociopaths. But the thing about the entire way Mary was written is, you know, I almost didn't watch the second episode after watching the first episode of this season. And one of the reasons was it just felt like the entire first episode of the season was a perfunctory attempt to write Mary out of the show. Because the writers went, "Oh, marriage is so boring. Married people are boring. Babies are boring. Shootouts are cool. How can we just as quickly as possible resolve this marriage problem we created for ourselves?"
With a shootout.
With a shootout.
Yeah, I think it's the problem that a lot of superhero media runs into, right? Because for all that it's a detective story, Sherlock is also a superhero story. Sherlock's superpower is being the world's greatest detective, but not like Batman, better than Batman. And in superhero stories, when the story becomes just about the relationships between superheroes and supervillains, then it migrates far away from the concerns of the viewer, from the world that we're more familiar with, which is why one of the most popular superheroes is always Spider-Man, the superhero who has a like very fleshed out ordinary life with a, you know, pretty full supporting cast. And Sherlock Holmes, as written by Conan Doyle, has a supporting cast in Watson and the police that he works with, but in the Sherlock series, all of his supporting cast have to themselves be superpowered in some way or another so that everything becomes this larger-than-life conflict involving, as it turns out, Sherlock and his set of siblings that have complicated schemes going back and forth.
One of whom is the British government.
Right.
I mean, that's in the original stories, mm-hmm. but Mycroft bulks large in this series. That's a pun.
Not as large as in the Christmas special.
No. That was one of the great things about the Christmas special, the weird tableau of Mycroft Holmes, which was Mark Gatiss in a fat suit, just surrounded by this Victorian abundance of, you know, these strange Victorian dishes and jello molds and just weird stuff.
The special was great. Pardon the pun, a way for the creators of the show to have their cake and eat it too. They wanted to keep doing modern Sherlock, but they also wanted to, you know, put in an incredibly concentrated form a bunch of pastiches and homages to the Victorian origins of the Sherlock character.
I really enjoyed that aspect of it. I love Victorian stuff. I love Gaslight. I love fog in London and Tweed and these things. And so I loved seeing them sort of transported back to that context.
But the Christmas special, like the current season, seemed to like in some way explore, but we have women characters.
The thing with the women was horrible. I could not deal,
But I mean, the Christmas special was all about like a drama about women so that men could learn about women. And now we have
Mary's strange alien race.
Oh my gosh. But then we have Mary's death and everything leading up to it as a way for the men to work out their friendship.
Exactly. This is so Eve Sedgwick.
And it's ridiculous, including, and this is what drove me up the wall and was really right. was pushing me away, like the ridiculous tacked-on semi-adultery plot.
Yeah.
Where everything about John and Mary's relationship is there to advance something about John's character, even in stupid ways. And there's nothing about how marriage changes or alters Mary, which is particularly odd given what you said about her. Like, oh, I knew I'd die, you know, eventually. How did that factor into her decision to get married and have a child? Has any of that changed something for her? When did she record that message, before or after she gave birth? And it was so frustrating because, you know, there are better stories you can tell. If your goal is even to just use women as a way of facilitating the character growth of men, you could still do it better than the current season of Sherlock did. And that was what was so frustrating for me, because there's an element of the second episode of this season where, you know, Mary thinks that what will pull John out of grief is if Sherlock puts himself in terrible danger and John has to save him. And what's interesting is John doesn't. He knows Sherlock is in a certain amount of danger. He hasn't run after him until he sees Mary's video saying John would do anything for Sherlock. And it's his wife's vision of him that calls him forth to a higher nobility and higher friendship. And that was such an interesting idea, you know, that what John has lost in losing his wife isn't just his wife, but it's a part of himself and a part of her image of him and what that makes him. You know, she won't be around to leave him little video messages to be a better person forever. There's a bit even in C.S. Lewis's The Four Loves where he says when you have a group of three friends and your friend Charles dies, you lose the Carolingian aspect of your remaining friend, what Charles brought out of him. And instead, they appeared to have added the adultery subplot to show again that gap between Mary's image of John and John's actuality, when they already had that very well in him going after Sherlock because Mary believed he would never abandon him. And it's a better story that way, that, you know, our spouses can awaken us to virtues big and small by just expecting more of us. That's a fascinating story. That's an amazing story to tell in the middle of grief, to grieve for part of yourself as well as your wife. And they dressed it up with bus adultery in a really comical and bizarre way.
To be clear for listeners who may not know or may have forgotten, the adultery plot line is just this weird thing in the first episode of this season where John sees a woman on a bus and they exchange cell phone numbers and text each other in a pretty anodyne way. But it's emotional infidelity. But I think it's, you know, it's interesting because it's interesting and slightly objectionable because it allows the showrunners to have it both ways. You know, they get to show John being unfaithful, but not so unfaithful that the audience is going to lose sympathy for him. It's going to be an extremely forgivable kind of infidelity. And Sherlock himself says at the end of episode two, "Listen, John, it was just texting. It's really okay."
He doesn't say it's forgivable.
No, he says that there was basically, you didn't do anything all that wrong in the first place, but the story is allowed to sort of get that mileage out of it.
Sherlock absolves
him. To make John more interesting.
Sherlock absolves him by saying, oh, it doesn't really matter and everybody does it, not by saying, you did a wrong thing, but you're repenting for it.
And this is such a pattern that drives me up a wall of that the way to offer comfort to our friends, you know, when they feel like they're stuck in sin, is to tell them that their sins aren't real, rather than to be with them through the actual work of repentance. You know, sure, John, like, did not sleep with this woman. He does feel he's betrayed his wife. That probably suggests in some way he did. A better friend than Sherlock would acknowledge that he has actual amends to make and not comfort him by asking him to mute his guilt and his actual sense of what is right.
I think it was Eve Tushnet who tweeted recently, "Does anyone write poems anymore about how some things are bad and it's okay to be ashamed of them?" Of course, we all know now, by the end of the second episode of this season of Sherlock, that the bus adultery was just part of a complicated scheme being orchestrated by Sherlock's long-lost secret sister.
Who has no basis in canonical Sherlock Holmes. I'm not a purist, but some things are just silly.
I think long-lost siblings are silly whether or not they appeared in the original text.
Right.
So you mentioned Eve Tushnet's comment about what is and isn't forgivable and how we get there. And I'm also fascinated by Tushnet's writing on addiction, where she says a lot of the modern conception of addiction is to always frame it as a disease. Because when you do that, there's no moral culpability. And it's a way of extending forgiveness to addicts by saying there's nothing to forgive. But also by kind of sending that secret extra message. And if there were something to forgive, of course we wouldn't forgive you. It's only because you're not morally culpable that it's all right that you use drugs. And Sherlock, like, doesn't have that disease model of addiction going on in the show, but that's because it has no particular model of addiction going on in the show. It just kind of throws it in for a little extra flavor occasionally with no real consequences or even, like, in-world rules to how Sherlock uses drugs or which drugs he uses.
Right. So the idea of Sherlock Holmes having a drug addiction is, of course, it begins in Conan Doyle. There's, you know, the famous 7% solution of cocaine that Holmes will inject sometimes when he's in his sort of downtime between big cases. It's something that disappears from the stories actually fairly quickly as Victorians were beginning to understand that these drugs are really not to be screwed around with recreationally, it became more disreputable. And Conan Doyle, I think, also wanted to sanitize Holmes a little bit, make him more family-friendly as the stories became more commercially viable. But anyway, there is that basis for Sherlock's drug addiction in the original stories. And the BBC series has been very weird with how they've kind of toyed with this idea. You know, they hinted in the early seasons that Sherlock had some kind of past with addiction. And then in the most recent episode, as well as once in season three, we're asked to entertain and sort of respond emotionally to the idea that Sherlock has relapsed on hard drugs. Although, again, it's very unclear which drugs he's supposed to be doing. You know, and then the other characters get really spun up about it. You know, you have this history with drugs. You can't be doing this. And Molly, you know, runs tests on his urine and slaps him across the face and says, "How dare you throw away the beautiful gifts you were born with by addling your beautiful brain with drugs?" You know, but it always turns out that although he is taking drugs, he's not actually on drugs somehow, because he's so superhuman that he remains in control of it in a way that normal people can't. And so he can use drugs as sort of a disguise or a trick or a ruse to manipulate criminals or manipulate John in some way. And I find it a very implausible and redundant conceit. A lot of people object to it for social reasons because it seems to make light of addiction. I just find it emotionally abusive because I keep wanting to invest in and care about this addiction subplot with Sherlock. And every time I try to, I get slapped down and told, "Ha, just kidding. You thought he was a junkie, but he's actually Superman." And so if this guy has no vulnerabilities, if the appearance of vulnerability is always just a ruse, then it's hard for viewers, I think, to get traction on him. And that seems to be increasingly a problem, I think, with the series.
You know what I think it is, Julia? I think it's the hashtag new Gnosticism. With the power of his supernatural mind, Sherlock can overcome the limits of the flesh.
I'm sure that's true.
Okay, you're joking, but I'm going to take that seriously for a second. The most interesting subplot about drugs they've ever done on Sherlock was in season 2, episode 2, Hound of the Baskervilles, where Sherlock is honestly the most frightened we see him in the whole series by the fact he saw something that wasn't there, and he doesn't trust his mind or his perceptions. Without that, he's unmoored in the world. And I really hoped in Baskerville that that was going to be our entry point into whatever his relationship with drugs was. Like, how is someone who's so, ironically, you know, for someone we think of as this highfalutin intellectual, intensely materialistic, bound into his sense of the world and his ability to model it and understand the very physical details of it, what kind of a relationship or what attraction do drugs and dissociative states have for that person? And of course, we never ever got that. Because it really, you know, you just get a tossed off line in the most recent episode that he's feeling psychedelic. But the Sherlock of Baskerville would particularly have no interest in psychedelic drugs. So I really feel they threw away interesting characterization about how he relates to his own mind and things that would distance it from it to achieve nothing.
Right. I agree. So there's an extremely lively Sherlock fandom, and it's very internet-based. And so the hardcore Sherlock fans, they have their little Tumblr blogs, and they're always looking for clips that they can turn into GIFs. They love to ship their favorite characters, that's to say, pair them off in relationships. So John Locke is the shipping name for pairing John and Sherlock. Others, you know, want to ship Sherlock and Moriarty, or Sherlock and Irene Adler, or Sherlock and Molly the lab tech, and on and on. And it's increasingly apparent that the showrunners are extremely aware of this fan culture. And they service it by providing shots that are very gif-able And fantasy sequences in which Sherlock makes out with anyone and everyone you ever fantasized that he would make out with. This was really a problem in season three and in the Christmas special. I find it extremely annoying. How do you guys feel about it?
I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, Julia, that I don't have a Tumblr, but I did go in with embroidery floss and restitch a buttonhole on my jacket in contrasting thread like Sherlock's couple years ago. But what I'd say is I think this has been a problem for the series, but they've pulled back on it a little.
I think that's true.
It was, you know, very silly at the beginning of season three. But if they confine it more to things like, you know, fantasy Christmas specials, I think that's actually exactly the right kind of outlet for that weird relationship between creator and fan, rather than in standard episodes.
I think we should remember that Arthur Conan Doyle was not immune to the demands of fandom either.
And well, he was not immune to the demands of money, but go ahead.
He resurrected Sherlock Holmes.
Because he needed money.
Well, also because people wrote him letters acting like he had murdered this character.
No, he waited so 10 years. He waited 10 years to bring him back.
I think it's within the grand tradition of Sherlock Holmes medium to be very, like, aware of what the readers are, or what the, you know, audience is saying and thinking about the story of Sherlock you're telling. And I think the creators of the show are having a laugh at their fandom sometimes. Like, all the possible ways Sherlock could have faked his death and
come back. Oh, but
they
loved doing that. They loved it.
I think part of that was them making fun of people coming up
no,
with
No, they
theories.
Were rewarding
I think it,
it
was a little making fun of and a little mean-spirited in some cases, where they cast the fans as the paranoia conspiracy theorists in their own episode.
But
sometimes
they gave them an
accurate,
awful
though.
Lot of screen time. You know, they... They said, here are, you know, three different ways that it could have happened, because we know you've been thinking about this, and so we're gonna play with you. I mean, I think the fans are playful enough that they understand and are not insulted by it, but...
I don't know. A lot of fans have turned against the creators of the show, feeling they're betraying the characters now. Like,
well, because they're not shipping the right people, right?
Or they feel Moffat has, you know, done bad things by writing his female characters poorly.
Oh, yeah.
So you agree with the fans on that one, Julia.
Yeah.
Well, Julia, yeah. We've got some Tumblrs to interest you in.
No, I don't think so. I just, you know...
Maybe you secretly ship Moffat and realistic depictions of female characters.
I'm not interested enough in Moffat to ship him with anyone. No, I mean, I turned on this series' depictions of women very early with what they did with Irene Adler. Who is, in the original stories, a very clever and very gifted opera singer who uses the threat of blackmail against a German prince, you know, for self-protection, and becomes very admired by Holmes, possibly in a way that's kind of erotic, but that's it's very interesting what Doyle is getting up to there, but it's a different conversation. And what Steve Moffat, the showrunner, did with her was to make her a very high-class lesbian dominatrix, which is just the tawdriest and most misogynistic way of updating a canny female character. You know, and then, so she's a lesbian who then falls in love with Sherlock. So she's a lesbian until her great hero comes along, which is such a classic, and I mean that in the most pejorative way, such a classic male fantasy. And so at that point, I was done with women on this show. And I didn't want Mary to be a major character. I didn't need Watson to have a wife who becomes a girl detective and sort of tags along with them. You know, that to me is patronizing. That was a way in which the showrunners were trying to say, oh, we can take a female character seriously. Well, and then what happened to her? You know, she got killed off in a way that made it very clear that she was only there to spice up the friendship between the two male characters anyway. So I've been over it for a long time.
I think Molly's been a stronger female character.
Oh, she does the same thing over and over again, and she just is a puppy dog for Sherlock.
Well, except, you know, she has this long-running crush on him, and over the course of the series, she grows a spine and stands up to him and notices things about him that no one else notices, partly because she's been watching him for a long time. But we get a sense before Sherlock fakes his own death of, like, that she has a quiet perceptiveness that's overlooked by everyone else on the show. But she's the only one to really call Sherlock out on the way he lies.
She also has nothing going on in her life except her obsession with Sherlock. Even when she tries to date someone, he's a clone of Sherlock.
It turns out it's Moriarty.
Well, it's either Moriarty or it's a guy who looks exactly like Sherlock.
Though some of those things are earlier in her arc, I think one thing we get a sense of when she's calling Sherlock out at the end of season two is that she does have a whole life, that she's had this father she nursed through death, you know, and it's just that people don't ask her about her life, but she's had this whole life, and it's more the blindness of the main characters that means we don't hear about her than kind of the narrowness of her own experience.
I think the problem is the showrunners are becoming as blind as their characters.
I think that's true.
I do like Mrs. Hudson. She's pretty cool. She's got like a whole life off screen that we get hints of.
Though a little bit like Mary, where they assume the way people are interesting is if they're badass in this very narrow scope of like previously having married a murderer, owning a sports car.
Running a drug cartel.
Versus Mrs. Hudson, and again in an earlier season, you know, playing up her oldness and her frailty to smuggle out an important MacGuffin for the episode, where her strength came from exploiting her age rather than speeding and being involved in a high-speed helicopter chase. Yes.
All right, so what do you guys hope will happen in the final episode of this season, which may or may not be the final episode of the series?
You know, I understand this is probably an unrealistic thing to hope for, but if we're going to have this third Sherlock sibling involved, I'd love for the focus to be off of their relationship and have all three of the siblings and Watson or whatever it is they want drawn into a new mystery that is independent of all of their lives and all of their relationships. And they work together, come together by being part of a broader world, not a narrower one. Something actually a lot like season three, episode two, where there's a mystery at John's wedding that isn't a mystery about someone sending a message to John or to Sherlock, that allows them to explore their relationship against someone else's real independent need.
I would be similarly interested in seeing a mystery that doesn't revolve solely around these characters. But I don't know if that's what they're going to go with for their grand finale. Maybe what I want in the grand finale is for Sherlock to believe that there's a Moriarty-related conspiracy that he must unravel. And then the big twist is that it's not Moriarty-related at all, but a series of independent things that just have to do with normal people committing normal crimes. And so the really surprising thing is that the world is bigger than just him and his nemesis / pseudo love interests. And then that's his big revelation that, you know, he comes to and discovers that the world is just a more complicated place than it has seemed as it's narrowed by these conspiracies involving him and his family relationships.
I mean, perhaps in the same way the most recent episode wove in a quote from Henry V, you know, the last episode of the season, and perhaps the series can weave in that Chesterton quote from Orthodoxy about the tremendous freedom to realize you're not the most important person in the world, that you're not the kind of small and petty god God would have to be for it to be you.
Are you suggesting that the end of Sherlock should be a crossover with Chesterton's detective Father Brown appearing to help Sherlock break out of his little microcosm?
Yes, I've revised my wish. That's my wish.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleague, Alexi Sargent, and to our guest, Leah Labresco. Thanks to Martin Scorsese for his great humility, and thank you, listeners. If I've forgotten anyone, we'll resolve it with a shootout.